We are talking about you went to the McLuhan Personal Library and fortunately took out Elias Canetti's Crowds and Power, and it's heavily annotated by McLuhan, and that's because crowds would be another term for media. All right.
Yeah, actually, right underneath the, on the title page where it just says crowds and power, underneath that he's written i.e. crowds as environment.
There it is. Yep, yep. I used that idea in my memo to Prince Charles on June 4th, 1987, which is in the liner notes of Bosnia Galsia. I have crowds slash media slash myths, all kinds of words lined up, equals advertising. Yeah, it's important. The media is about affecting other media, which is linguistic mortar, in Ionic terms, affecting other mortar. And it actually, media don't affect you personally. It's the crowd dynamic that affects, that is affected.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a medium is.
Yeah, there's a pretty there's one. I mean, I had one other. I was only there for an hour, and I was looking at one other book with only a few annotations as well. So I only was looking at Crowds and Power for the last maybe 20 minutes. So there will definitely be more to come on that. But one of the very few things that I saw speaks right to that point, where he's talking about, he's imagining like someone who is listening to a sermon. Can imagine that it was the sermon itself that really, you know, did it for them, whereas, and what McLuhan has underlined is the large number of listeners gave him more satisfaction than the sermon itself.
The speaker? It gave the speaker.
Oh, no, the listener.
Ah, the fact that it was the emotional multitude is what had the impact.
Yeah, that he's sitting there in a big crowd listening to it.
Right. Now that
and actually, above that same, he underlined that phrase, the large number of listeners gave him more satisfaction than the sermon itself. And at the top of the page, he has written versus med versus mess, like medium versus message.
Right.
Like, because it's an important point that although the physical properties of the medium itself and, you know, like how TV works versus how radio works and the sense amplified and et cetera, and that's all very important for McLuhan, that still it's what the medium is about is the crowd and the shaping of the audience and to what type of a, like the different ways that you're together in a crowd, like when you're reading a book that lots of people have read, it's not a mass medium, but you can still feel, you know,
yeah,
different because you're reading something millions have read versus when you're simultaneously all sitting down to watch Ed Sullivan versus when you're watching something on a DVR, you know?
Okay, let me see. So the statement that's by Canetti about the large number of listeners, that's a statement by Canetti, and McLuhan's commenting on it. Well, that's exactly what Mark, who likes the music, but I told him when I wasn't playing music, you can go back to the previous show's archives and hear the music. He says, no, it's the live element. And I agree with him. I always noticed if I bought a record back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was okay, but it wasn't as powerful as hearing it on the local radio station. It's the emotion of multitude that is the key fact of Discarnate Man. The mass man, that's the simultaneity, the ESP that goes on. And McLuhan used to say, it didn't matter what you put on the radio. It was the fact that you were simultaneously engaging in the same space was the emotional factor. So, yeah. And then that's what makes, so then Mark saying, Bob, when you're playing music and we're all listening, that's extra than just hearing the archive. So Canetti seemed to get that.
Yeah, definitely speaking directly to that. And the other thing it reminded me of was I still like them, but not so much. I used to be pretty, and a few years ago I was really into Stewart and Colbert, watching their shows. And I've gone on a bit about that before, but it's an interesting thing about that where, you know, where one of them will, if they're delivering a particularly well-turned cutting slam on someone, then the pleasure in hearing that is not, it has something to do with like, oh, they really nailed them, but what gives it the power and what makes people really latch on to being fans of those shows is the idea that enough people heard that it actually makes an impact. It's not like, oh, Stewart really laid into them last night on their show. It's not like, It's not just, oh, my friend said the best thing about them. It's like, and no, but millions of people heard it.
Yeah, now that's interesting in terms of we apparently only have 11 listeners, but sometimes it's a little more. But everybody who's listening with Ion talking, they get the emotion multitude, and that's because Ion says we got more listeners in other worlds than in this world. So we really have an emotional multitude, and that's why it seems to be a huge impact, the show. And it is in terms of numbers if you include other worlds, but there's only four or five people apparently interacting. So we do that paradoxically, I think. I think we've just brought to a new point about Ion. Let's just see if Ion has something to say about that. Not too much, because I don't want to distract. Just say, you want to elaborate on that, Ion, for a minute, about the emotional multitude and what you bring to it?
Well, it's very simple. It's an easy process. It's the affect, not the effect. That
affect is
shift.
The emotion.
And effect is how it lands.
Yes. So do we have the affect of more than 11 people listening through your resonance, your voice, your frequency?
Most certainly. Just what you hear, you can hear that time and time again, even from what you call your archives. Which actually is from then, from now till then, but then from world to world to world, it's prolific.
That's a good point. So our archives have the effect of live. That's a good point because you're a part of it. All right, I got to put you back.
Don't do that. We have the capacity where you've proven that, where people are saying, and Ion says, and someone was washing the dishes and they pulled something up and they dropped the dish right then, and I was dropping it right then, and I dropped the dish right then. And it'll be way, what you call in your future, same thing, song, different verse.
So that's not emotion, that's effect, not affect, that's effect.
Exactly, very good.
Yeah, okay, let me just put you on hold for a second. Okay, Brian, the next quote or next point you want to say.
Well, actually there's another, McLuhan has another little note on that same page where he's underlined Kennedy saying the large number of listeners of the sermon gave him more satisfaction than the sermon itself. At the top, he's written medium versus message, as well as E.F. Gould's switch to recording as retrieval modules.
What is that first part? E.S.? What's that? E.S.?
Oh, C.F., like the...
Oh, also, sensory closure. Like, that's sensory closure.
Oh, no. Not just the little C.F., like a little editorial note, like... Also related to, not sure exactly what the CF stands for, but
I was thinking of
not one of McLuhan's not one of McLuhan's little notes, but yeah, Gould's switch to recording as retrieval modules.
So he said, sure cool. Exactly wait a minute, Brian. The first part he says,
Gould, Glenn Gould.
Oh, Gould switched to recording as a retrieval mode. That's right. He left the concert hall.
Mm-hmm.
So he has to explain Gould. So he's saying Gould switch to recording to retrieve what?
Well, it says retrieval modules, and I'm not sure exactly what he means by that phrasing, but he's saying that this thing that Kennedy pointed out about that it's the fact of listening to the sermon with a whole bunch of other people was more important, more contributing to the enjoyment than the sermon itself. McLuhan seems to be noting that this is exactly what Gould was picking up on and realizing, I want people to be paying attention to, you know, my music rather than just the experience of sitting in a concert hall.
So he shut the people out and tried to get back to the message, I guess, not the motion of the crowd. That's interesting. Yeah, he went private.
It's like he's had with the recording, he's having a bunch of one-on-one conversations with his listeners rather than a big emotional multitude thing.
Right. Right. Okay, that's very interesting. He being a literate private person, that was more important to get the whatever he thought his message was is more important than the emotion.
Mm.
And that is what there's this great book called Ezra Pound and Wyndham Lewis and Radical Modernism by Vince Sherry, professor on the East Coast, and he wrote about the ideology, and they were actually called the ideologues in the 19th century. The guys who favored the detached eye versus the emotional ear. And the emotional ear took over at the end of the 19th century, first part of the 20th century. So then the detached eye people decided to come back. And Wyndham Lewis was part of that, and so was Ezra Pound. It's very interesting. So Gould is being Lewisian, by trying to retrieve the I as opposed to the musical emotion or the crowd emotion.
But Bob, wasn't it said about Gould that he was kind of an unemotional type person?
Unemotional.
Unemotional.
Yeah, he was.
I mean, that was just his character. He was.
Yeah.
He was a loner. And,
well, your criticism is autobiographical. I mean, anybody's criticism. He expressed the ideas that went with his personality. You know, his personality was an isolated guy, and so he went with the I and detachment.
Yeah, so it wasn't so much artistic ploy as just a personal preference.
Yes, but that became his artistic strategy. I mean, he had, you know, Lewis defined art as a colossal preference. Okay, that's the definition. So the artist puts on a colossal preference, and that's tried to be done technically.
Mm-hmm.
It's close, the personality and the art, but the artist likes to think that he is not so much in his art. I don't know, mm-hmm. Brian, you're a musician. Do you try to put yourself into your band, into it?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's much more nebulous in terms of your actual personality going into just a little improvised line of music.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I tend to identify like myself and my personality with words or something. And yeah, I mean, it feels like it's a personal statement of some kind, but a much more fuzzy, low definition, or definitely tending towards whatever I have in common with people in general rather than what makes me unique.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not about when I'm laying down a little flute line on top of the bed of sounds and the flowers of hell, I'm not really, it's not so much about my personal point of view, you know. I'm just
right, so that's the ratio.
Nicely.
That's
yeah.
The ratio within music. And it's more music, it's more a group in the music medium, and then the medium itself is evoking the group of feeling in people. But now if you wrote a book, you might want to put your little self in there, you know what I mean? It'd be more yourself in the ratio in the writing, because
mm-hmm.
the medium would enhance that. The writing
yeah.
will enhance your spin. Anyways, it's ridiculously complex. I don't know why we bring it up.
It's interesting with respect to Crowds and Power, because it's definitely the kind of book that is aiming to be less personal and more he's trying to describe the most general experiences and general patterns. And sure, he has his own kind of style, but it's more the
he's trying to talk technically, and he has a great explanation of why the Jews got in trouble in Germany. As inflation made the Jews, Germans feel smaller, they had to lash out at some crowd, and the Jews were there. And it was an environmental effect, not personal hatred, something like that. Kennedy makes a very subtle, different new point, and McLuhan used to quote it. I don't know, you can look for that point when you get to it and see what McLuhan writes, because he used to highlight it a lot. It was... The scapegoating of the Jews was due to the inflationary effect of the money and the Germans' identity. So they went for the tribe that caused the money inflation,
right.
Not necessarily because they were bankers. I'm not sure. Not explaining it very well, but there was apparently some different point that he was making that McLuhan thought illustrated his point, that the... The fate of the Jews was not based on what normally people think it is. It's this other radio effect.
Yeah, I'll definitely look for that point
sometime
in the next few weeks when I go back there.
You can even see the index. Look up Jews. Maybe it goes right into it if it's in the index, if there is an index.
I don't think there is, but maybe there is. I don't know. But there was one thing, I'm not sure if this came through, if I mentioned it in the first part. I don't know if I said before that McLuhan wrote under the title Crowds and Power. McLuhan wrote i.e. Crowds as Environment.
Yes.
So that's his very basic understanding of the whole thing, that that you know, the crowd, that there's the question
an environment.
Of, yeah, and that the main action of you know, that the medium, the physical sense ratio of the medium itself is important, but what is important about it is the type of crowd it creates.
Yes, and I am saying there's an effect and an affect. So it would be interesting to figure out what the Jews suffered from, affect or effect. But the crowd dynamic in the media environments, the Jews were identified with one of the environments and perceived as had to be spanked, you know, by the other environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book begins with the very first section title is The Fear of Being Touched.
Mm-hmm.
And the first point he makes is that, and in the back, McLuhan has a note for this point saying, like, this is relevant to Edward Hall's things about spaces.
Yes.
and all that, and he noted spaces beside the phrase, all the distances which men create around themselves are dictated by this fear, and then McLuhan wrote both CA for cliched archetype, and I don't know about why the CA so much, but he wrote chiasmus next to this basic reversal point. It is only in a crowd that man can become free of this fear of being touched. That is the only situation in which this fear changes to its opposite.
Are you quoting Kennedy there?
That long sentence is Kennedy.
You actually get a more complex McLuhan because he's taking text and then making his gloss on it. It makes a more subtle dialogue from McLuhan than his normal writing style. See, this is what's pretty neat about this this library, showing a new level. Now, McLuhan, on one of the recordings we played last week, did cite the fact that Arabs, they'll come close to you and share breath. They will breathe on you, and you're supposed to smell their breath, and they smell your breath. That's how they, and it's an insult if you don't exchange breath real closely. And then other people, there's another kind of smell. So, yeah, the Edward T. Hall did the book on that. It was called The Silent Language and Hidden Dimension, I think. Those two books were McLuhan used.
It makes sense that Kennedy chose that to start off. That, I mean, it's on the first page, that basic reversal, that it's only in a crowd that people not only lose this fear of being touched, but it changes into the kind of, you not only, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's some places that if people can, they will stand in a little atomized, keeping a centimeter of space around them in a crowd. But more generally, if you're in a huge crowd that's at some concert or some speech of a charismatic leader or something, that you kind of partially are getting off on the feeling of everyone is standing shoulder to shoulder and not being bothered by that. I think it's particularly interesting with the phenomenon that I wonder if this ever happened earlier, but it's generally thought of as more of a 90s, maybe late 80s phenomenon of the mosh pit, which I certainly have some firsthand knowledge of this phenomenon that definitely emphasizes this reversal of being in a crowd actually leads to the fear of being touched turning into its opposite, that when people are dancing to something that's nice and rowdy, hard, fast music, rock or techno, heavy rock of some kind, that that people are not only just dancing and okay with touching the people next to them, but that becomes the whole point of the dancing is slamming into the people next to you and having a great time bouncing around that way.
Okay, electric music is tactile. McLuhan says you push tactility for Americans, you push to extreme, it flips into kinetic space. So the kineticism of the American bias is heightened by the 80s in the mosh pit, or maybe even the late 70s, the electronic punk reality made, they were preserving kinetic space.
Yeah,
kinetic contact.
Actually, I guess that's probably, because I think Crowds and Power is 70s book, right?
I think it's earlier. I think it's 60s. 50s, 60s. I can look it up. It's been around a long time in my mind because I think McLuhan was talking about it in the 60s, Crowds and Power. So, yeah, go on to your next idea.
Okay. Sorry, I just had to talk to someone there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's one. Let me whip this one out. Here's a great little.
In 1960. And it was called Maß und Mach in German.
Right.
Then someone else.
I was just...
Who's calling us, Carol? You want to answer that? Who's that? It's coming from Toronto. Is this your mother calling you, Brian? Are you in trouble with your family?
No, that's funny, though, because I just for a second someone came to the door and was letting me know that, like, the landlord was trying to get in touch with us here.
Right.
But,
let's see what that
is. Of course, I'm on the phone.
What is it, Carol? Are they speaking?
Not yet.
Let's just see if this is it.
No,
they hung up, so I don't know what that was. At least it wasn't Corbin. Corbin usually, now that we have two phones, we can be nailed on this. Now they're calling back. Let's see. We'll give out the number, 416-414-129, and I won't give the last digit. Why don't you just answer, Cal? You can tell them you're not available. See what they say.
Oh, that's definitely a Toronto number.
Yeah, it sounds like a patient. Yes, it's a patient. Okay, from Toronto, though. See, there's the vibe. You're speaking from Toronto. So the crowd dynamic in the mosh pit. Oh, yeah, so literate visual man doesn't want to touch too much. Then you put him into an environment of public address systems and acoustic space. Then the visuality shifts. And then they allow themselves to be touched because it's an acoustic, not so visual. And maybe a necessary release from the habit of a literate day-to-day lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Or almost as if everyone is visually focused on one thing at once and it kind of numbs the more tactile sense.
Right.
So you don't care anymore whether you're brushing up against someone because you're all like hypnotically, magnetically attracted to the one thing you're looking at.
Okay, and I just want to see if Ion has... Wait, would you add something to this, Ion? Are we off base from your particular about the touch becoming non-touch?
Well, you're losing the effect of the effect of how it applies. You got the words right, but they don't apply. When you start connecting it, it doesn't connect.
Well, when the people don't mind being touched, is that an affect,
No, when the people don't mind being touched, that's an effect if they're touched. But if they're not touched and they want to be, then that's an affect.
Okay, so what are we mixing up?
The juxtaposed position of do they want to be touched and are they being touched? You're assuming from your hypotheses that they want to be touched and they don't necessarily.
Well, we're just saying they allow themselves and they even might keep a centimeter aside. They're a bit polite in the Western crowd, in the European crowd. They don't totally press up against them.
But you're basing your position on that they want to be, and that's the false premise.
No, we're saying we
cannot.
We're not saying they want to be touched. They allow themselves to be the terrible, overcome the fear of touch and allow the crowd slightly to touch each other only because that's the effect of the public address system in the crowd, and they forgo their really strict attitude towards being touched when they're not in a group.
That would be an affect, not an effect.
Well, what would be an affect? The fact that they let go on it?
That they want to be touched at that level.
We're not saying they want to be. They're allowing themselves to be touched and putting up with it.
And that is an affect, not an effect.
Okay. All right. Well, that's what McLuhan, he remained limited to just talking about effects. Don Thiel, who tried to bring in affect, A and E, and mix them up in his writings. He always thought McLuhan simplified it too much. So, and you're agreeing with Theo. You say you have to have E in the A.
Oh, yes. God bless Don Theo. The world couldn't turn without him.
Yeah, he's very important now. Okay, we're going to put you on mute for a second, Ion. Okay, Brian, next point. if there is.
There is a pretty juicy note. It's not, I guess, a note to the entire book. It's on not even the title page, but just before the title page, the first blank page that he's got his name up there in the corner saying, this is my book. And then in the middle of that page, he says, urban congestion as psychedelic anesthesia.
Wow, urban congestion. Oh, no, okay, he wrote about that several times. It's even in From Cliched Archetype. He said many yokels consider going to the modern city in the 60s as a psychedelic experience. So
yeah.
Urban congestion equals psychedelic synesthesia? Is that what it was?
Psychedelic anesthesia.
Ah, okay. Well, he thought
that's
drugs were numbing. We actually,
like,
yesterday or last week, he was talking about psychedelics and LSD was an attempt to numb oneself from the information overload, which is not what people thought they were doing.
Yeah, or the other phrase I remember, I'm not sure if it was in something that was published or there was an unpublished review of the variety of psychedelic experience that you or Andrew Crystal got out of the archives once, where he said, no, actually, I think this was in the Medium in the Light. Never mind. But anyway, where he said that psychedelics can be seen as a forlorn attempt to try to speed up the mind and nervous system to match the speed of the electric or electronic environment. So, yeah, it's kind of an anti-numbing anti-environment or not. I mean, numbing, I guess, would be a kind of an effect or affect of it. I'm not sure about the... But that other idea that it's a kind of an attempt to match the environment you're in is so much bigger than your normal awareness that trying to rev up that it's almost like a weird car metaphor of the psychedelic experience is an attempt to speed up to a level that is capable of matching the urban chaos, the electronic environment chaos.
Yeah, let me add to that. He did review the varieties of psychedelic experience, which came out in 65, 66, and he said none of the regular arts or sciences would serve as an anti-environment or an appropriate something to the global theater that we were now in the 60s. And he thought the psychedelics were the best art form at that point. They probably were the only thing that would set up some kind of either attempting to tune into it, catch up to it, or create an anti-environment to it. He then says in 68 in War and Peace of Global Village that those that take psychedelics are trying to get rid of their visual bias and tune into the modern environment. So that's similar to what he says to varieties of psychedelic experience a couple years before. But then in Counterblast in 69, he now says blast psychedelics as forlorn strategy in chemical warfare. So And we played a recording a week or so ago where he talked about drug taking is the lazy man's way of tuning in. So he had a lot of different responses over a 3 or 4 year period. But that would be natural if you understand McLuhan said, okay, we've got a new environment, it has these services, but we've got to turn it off before it flips into disservice. So let's program it, turn it off. Well, they never turned the psychedelics off. And so, therefore, he started to get down on it because it was becoming overused. So that may account for his changes of opinion.
Or almost that the attempting to turn it off in terms of making it illegal only pushed it into an area where it was not being kind of consciously paid attention to.
You can't ban something that the people require because the corporate society has all this mixed media synesthesia effects going on, and the Ronald Reagans and that are immature or impractical, saying, oh, we just have to say no. You can't. You're making money as General Electric. Make psychedelicizing everybody. You're going to have every generation want these to tune into it. So you have to orchestrate. You got to turn off your General Electric first.
Mm-hmm.
That was the hypocrisy of management. They were trying to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah. That. Well, I mean, yeah, and I wonder about whether bringing in the phrase of chemical warfare there, I wonder if that had something to do with him cluing into
MK Ultra.
The ground of.
Now here, let me tell you something about that. We played a couple weeks ago. I could actually look up if someone was interested. He suddenly says in this recording in 67, 68 that Pearl Harbor was planned. And that is a big conspiracy meme over the last 10, 15 years, but nobody said that in 67. And
yeah.
A couple of people wrote to me, says, oh, my God, McLuhan was right tuned into that. And he just lays out this conspiracy thing. He doesn't call it that. He just says, well, Roosevelt and them set it up so that they could get into the war. And that's pretty ostentatious to nail it on that patriotic world of Pearl Harbor. And so if he could think that way about Pearl Harbor, he definitely would have people, CIA people, telling him stuff just because he was famous along the lines of MKUltra, because he would have known about you and Cameron at McGill in 64.
Right.
Yeah. So, yes, and that's before Boehr discovered it. And May Breslau was starting to get on to it in 69, 70. So, yep, you can include that part in McLuhan's thinking.
That's great.
That's what you're looking for, trying to find that in the library, indications
yeah.
of that.
Yeah, totally. Actually, that interests me, the idea, the phrase you pulled out a minute there ago, that he said something about LSD being the lazy man's anti-environment.
Yeah.
Lazy.
Yeah.
That reminds me of the whole, kind of vertical versus horizontal kind of school of wisdom or
yeah.
religious experience, or spiritual strategy of the...
That would be the horizontal hand. School to take
yeah,
LSD.
The lazy school is the just kind of cruising for some sudden annihilatory experience
yes.
without any hard work, and the vertical is the
hard work. The vertical is the hard work.
Meditation, yeah.
Yeah, meditation is more Eastern and horizontal, where you annihilate yourself, whereas the Platonic, and that can be Aristotelian, but mainly Asian, but the Platonic thing is through... self-knowledge and dialectic, you have a moral discipline and you ascend above the hoi polloi. But the way he describes the horizontal, as you plunge into the sensory reality of mirrors ricocheting among themselves, your senses are ricocheting, that's a total psychedelic metaphor or
Absolutely.
Description. And,
yeah.
So the lazy, I would say to be spiritual in the 60s, you had to be in the corpus callosum in the interval, be aware of both the Platonic and the Asian, and know the limitations of either side. And I think that's the spiritual revolution McLuhan represented. He was in neither camp. Remember he said,
right.
I'm against the cult of the East and the cult of the West. Both cults.
Yeah. And it makes sense, too, especially that McLuhan, along those lines, would plug or hype up the symbolist. Because
yeah.
the other book that I was looking at, I got this one out as well because I knew there were only a few notes in it, was Baudelaire's The Essence of Laughter. And reading through that book a bit, I was pretty surprised by Baudelaire's stance on this whole vertical versus horizontal thing, because I really, like, maybe I'm just wrong, but I really thought that Baudelaire had more of a reputation as being more horizontal, kind
yeah.
of annihilatory kind of guy.
Yeah.
But, no, in this book, he comes off as a very strong vertical school kind of guy. Like, particularly I read a bit of his section where he's writing about hashish. And, you know, he has some positive things to say about the effects of hashish, but ultimately he's very dismissive of it in terms of it being any kind of a real road to any kind of wisdom, and he just really comes across sounding like a classic, like the conclusion is just very classic vertical school of he's
yeah.
got this, he paints this portrait of the true seeker who through hard work has managed to, like literally raising themselves above the crowd, looking down on the crowd who are, you know, desperately demand, like he describes it as explicitly the satanic demand for some kind of push button revelation.
Yeah,
Give me a drug that will just do it to me without me needing to put any work into it. That was just really surprised to find that, well, Baudelaire is totally a vertical guy. And so,
well, not totally, but...
Well, exactly. The important point
the
being
end,
not totally.
But in the end, he's a writer, and he's a literate guy. So his fundamentalism, genetic or mimically, is to the detached perspective in the end. And McLuhan says that the first wave of symbolists were the romantics, and they withdrew from the cities and went to nature, and they used that to be an image of mental states. But remember, they were studying mental states, so they're trying to be detached. And that's the
right.
Western way. So then Baudrillard realized that the city was here to stay, and you can't run from it. So he plunged into the shop windows and the urban landscape with that detached second wave of romantic symbolist. You know, he's a romantic symbolist second wave. So now this is where you bring in Terence McKenna. McKenna would upset someone like William Irwin Thompson, who's in the Yeats quadrant of my chart, because he is still a visually detached, favoring the visual detachment. So Thompson
yeah.
wanted to do yoga and all this stuff. So he was a Westerner, vertical, but he had to go horizontal because the Global Theater made everybody duped into the horizontal. So he picked a detached form of horizontal, yoga, whereas Terence McKenna said, forget the yoga, just take the ayahuasca and go right
yeah.
there to heaven. Don't wait around for a seminar. And that's what's interesting, where McKenna and Thompson butt heads over this based on responding to a hopelessly horizontal thing. And McLuhan writes a metaphor. He writes in one of his reviews in Renaissance that Joyce and Finnegan's Wake knew the vertical and the horizontal, but he chose to present the horizontal mixed media of Finnegan's Wake because he knew that's what would take over. So it was a conscious decision to put on the horizontal metaphor, but it wasn't that he was personally for it. But he knew he had to deal with that.
Right. That that makes sense. I mean, I thought of the Baudelaire thing when you were talking about corpus callosum.
Yeah.
Being aware of both sides, and so the fact that I was surprised by what seemed to be Baudelaire's kind of vertical bias, but with obviously an awareness of and a certain appreciation of the hashish side. But that's interesting, the difference between him and a Joyce side, that Joyce is more understanding that there's no point in just trying to be a bit appreciative of it and then go back to the other side because,
yeah.
you know, horizontal thing is coming in as a flood. And
you have to learn how to navigate in it.
Yeah.
You have to learn. So let me just ask Ion this. Bruce Powell is teaching Yeats's A Vision, and I don't have a copy here in this room, but I have one in the back. He wanted to know, Ion, and I wanted to know, what was Yeats attempting to do with his cosmic explanation in his book, A Vision? Do you have any insight on that, W.B. Yeats?
The Yeats Quadrant? Are you nuts? Is this too? Are we joking? What in the world are you talking about? Yeats didn't even come into the equation. You coming in there talking all this high-minded bunch of bullshit. Yeah. Yeats didn't even apply. How would you dare bring Yeats into
the I have Yeats in the Croker Quadrant.
Well, it had to be Croker Quadrant because the Queen would be slipping something up your bum. That's the whole point. It doesn't apply. It's some ethereal out there somewhere. You can't get there from here. Well, we would say bullshit, but we
well,
wouldn't want to
that,
so
that's
crap.
Too easy. You're taking the lazy man's way of just, swearing. How about what did Yeats mean by his vision? He was trying to show the fourfold cycles.
He didn't
what
have
do you
one.
Think he was
That's
getting?
What he was trying to lay. He didn't have one. That's why he was trying to lay out the parameters. He was trying to give the parameters to see a visionary vision. That was the point.
Like my chart. He was like my chart.
Well, but yet the difference is your chart goes somewhere. You can go from the Thompson, you can go to, he did not. You stopped in trying to figure out the chart. You got to the Thompson quadrant. It stops at the Thompson quadrant. That's where your chart stops. William Irwin Thompson finishes your chart.
Hey, what happens to the, you mean Croker comes before Thompson?
It completes it.
Well, I would say that's your bias. You're the mystical tradition in a way, even though you're not
but of course.
To that, but...
Oh, but of course,
you would be seen to be in the Thompson quadrant.
Fine, but as you know, well, okay, we yield, Mr. Chairman, we yield. However, but that goes full circle. Once you go full circle, then that's fine. If once you can, if you can pass the tiny note, Yates does not pass the tiny note. So if it doesn't pass the tiny note, then it doesn't matter.
Good point. Okay, so INETs don't end in the Thompson quadrant, but the chart will put you there in the end.
Do.
All right. Okay, I don't know, that might have helped, Brian. Let's, what will you want to carry on with McKenna? Any more on the vertical versus the, Baudelaire, his image is he's a dope smuggling pervert, right?
Yeah.
Good Lord, suffering cats. He's just a Lebanese hash sucking motherfucker. You nuts. He doesn't even know where he is.
Now, yeah, okay. You would swear this is not a family show. Family Guy. We don't swear. We're not a family type of show. We don't swear. Fuck you. Yeah. Okay. So, what were we? I had a thought there. Oh, Baudelaire. Baudelaire, McLuhan used to point out that he had a seminar every 7 days. He said it was hebdomadal, you know, like McLuhan would have one every Monday night. So here's Baudelaire. He might have been doing drugs the rest of the week, but he still wanted to have an intellectual seminar on one day a week.
Yeah.
He had a salon. Do you ever hear much about that? You ever read that?
No, not really. I mean, I always have just kind of, you know, I hear McLuhan talking about how you have to be super familiar with all the symbolists, and I'm always just like, no, I'm not really. I only have a vague notion of them, and I'll just stick with my McLuhan. And I don't know, like, this was the first Baudelaire I've ever read.
So. Right. Well, why he said you have to know about the symbolists, because they had such a big influence on Pound, Eliot, Joyce, and probably Yeats, you know, that they are the first, the phase before. In Thiel's PhD, he writes about that the vorticists were post-symbolists. They weren't redoing the symbolists. Yeah. They were beyond symbolism, but because the environment was so different from 40 years before. But it's always good to understand the symbolists, because now Mallarmé, he had his own salon too, and he held forth in the salon, and he's the one who was putting on the newspaper anarchy with the poem called Un coup de dé, which was the throw of the dice. And did you notice my notes that I posted on Thiel's manuscript?
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, there's a lot about Mallarmé and this and that throughout that book, and what he... He was one of the first to move into the post-verbal with that kind of poetry, Un coup de dé. That's UNCOUPDEDES, I think, with a cute over the E or a grave or something like that. I like what McLuhan says. He says, the scientist is busy inventing new things, because they hoped that the new technologies would prop up a vision they'd gotten from their humanist education. In other words, a rearview mirror reason for bringing in these new technologies. And the artists are saying, no, man, these new technologies are altering everybody already.
Hmm.
Yeah, Carolyn, do you want to say something? Oh, so that's an important thing, is the artist is dealing with the new effects, the effects and the affects, and the scientist thinks he's always staying in 1850 to improve that world as he brings in atomic bombs and all that for the 1850 purpose. And Joyce and the artist say, no, this is 1990 already. See, that's the difference between the artist and scientists. Scientists are doing their radical altering of the population with their new inventions for old rearview mirror purposes.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of just McLuhan's line on ESP, basically, that particularly that the 60s and 70s was a big time for ESP research and trying to, if not make a technological explicit ESP, then at least use technology like brainwave technology to try to get a more detailed pinning down on telepathy and that kind of thing. There was actually a third book I didn't mention in the email. The third book I looked at yesterday was Supernature by Lyle Watson.
Yes, that's an interesting book.
I wish there'd been more notes in it and more Lyle Watson books, because I really like that guy. I find that he's not really taken very seriously, but I find that his books, especially The Romeo Error, which is about death and the difference between death and life, that was very interesting stuff. But in Supernature, there were literally only two notes on the back cover, Okay. And one of them was about page 211, Possum, about how the possum is the best at playing dead. And different animals have playing dead as a kind of a more automatic instinct, but the possum seems to more consciously play dead and be wide awake while it's playing dead, and it's not entirely paralyzed while it's doing that. So, but there was no more specific note. But the other note was...
Oh, let me, Brian, let me say, you know that T.S. Eliot was called the Old Possum by Ezra Pound.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the inside joke. Is
that anything to do with playing dead?
Yes, Eliot played dead and let Pound alter the wasteland, edit it.
Huh.
And apparently Pound, somebody thought that maybe Eliot was just playing possum. That's what they call them, old possum. He let Eliot, Pound do all the work, but he knew Pound would make it the way he wanted it. It wasn't that Pound was altering the wasteland against Eliot's desires.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely McLuhan means that in there, too.
Okay. Well, yeah, the one other note in Supernature is about a place in the book where it's talking about ESP research. So, I mean, McLuhan's whole insight about, like, well, you're talking about ESP, we've got kind of an ESP already. We got this technological ESP.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's a great point or whatever, but it's possible that you could, that people might think of that as something more flippant that he was saying, and that he maybe didn't really know that he thought that ESP was just a, whether it was fake or not real, or just like a satanic thing or something, that he maybe didn't pay much attention to it. But he clearly, you know, at least read this one section in Supernature where they were getting pretty in detail about some experiments where, some Russian experiments where they had the sender person and the receiver person, and they're 400 miles away, but they have the receiver person hooked up to a brainwave machine so that they're paying, you know, they're looking really closely at what their brain's doing. And the receiver would get into an alpha brainwave mode, which was his kind of ready receive mode. And they found that the receiver's alpha brainwaves were suddenly blocked within seconds of the sender beginning to send, unbeknownst to the receiver. Like, the receiver had no notion of when they would begin to send, but suddenly his alpha brainwaves would shift when so they confirmed that there was some kind of a thing, that they did it, ran it enough times that it didn't seem to be coincidence, and it was always within a few seconds of the time that the sender said they were sending, that, boom, the receiver's alpha brainwaves were suddenly blocked. And not only that, but they were paying closer attention to the brain, and they found that the specific parts of the receiver's brain which became active instead of just the alpha brainwaves tended to correspond to the appropriate sense of the message. Like, sometimes the sender would be sending an image, and it would be the occipital or visual lobe that the receiver would become active, or sometimes the sender would be sending a thought of a sound, and it would be the temporal or audio lobe that the receiver would become active. So McLuhan doesn't have any note about that other than just in the back saying, page 256, where they talk about it changes in sender and receiver. So just basically to know that's interesting. And so he read that. He knew something about the details of ESP research that was going on. And that.
And what book was this? Was this in Kennedy? Or?
That's Supernature.
Oh, in Supernature. Okay. Yeah, that book's in the Thompson Quadrant. A couple points on ESP. There's an interview he did with June Callwood, who was the main woman reporter in the 70s, like a Barbara Frun kind of archetype. And so McLuhan respected her, so she publishes the informal Marshall McLuhan, where Marshall talked about his relationship with his kids and this and that. And he said they lost their identity like kittens lost their mittens. And she was struck at how casual he was about their identity crisis. But so she's responding to him personally. But I got to hear the audio, the actual tape recording of the interview. I don't know how I got it. And in it, and she leaves this other article, McLuhan says he has ESP and that he can tell when someone in New Guinea is thinking about him. Now, that would be Ted Carpenter, maybe, because Ted Carpenter was working in New Guinea. But that's 69-70, so I'm not sure. But it's often McLuhan will make a statement, even a personal statement, that's embedded with symbolism and structural composition, like saying the possum is the most important fake death guy, and that's referring to Eliot secretly. So anyway, he says he can tell when someone in New Guinea is thinking about him. Then he writes back in the 50s that the electric environment is ESP. Now, the reason he might not say much about Lyle Watson is that that's visually biased matching ESP. Okay, I'm going to send out a message. Do you get the message? And Don Thiel points out that the other senses, the haptic, the proprioceptive, the acoustic, and I guess the kinetic, they communicate among themselves and between people, and that's not usually included in the superficial version of ESP. And the electric environment brings in non-visual ESP, whereas what you're reading is visual matching abilities. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's like, does ESP refer to just that limited kind of matching of a sent thought with a received thought, or does it refer to mental powers in general? Like the other thing that was in the section of Supernature that McLuhan had noted was talking about how for telepathy seemed to be associated with these alpha brain waves, whereas psychokinesis abilities or phenomena seem to be associated with a beta brainwave, and so that's a very different thing. And psychokinesis is kind of a more appropriate metaphor for the electronic making things happen at a distance just by being there electronically kind of thing.
Yeah.
That like the electronic ESP is a bit more of a psychokinetic ESP than a telepathic ESP.
Well, if angels had ESP, we were becoming electrically super angels because we could do more than angels. We could be in a million places at once, whereas the angel can be wherever they want to be, but they're only there wherever they go to. They're only there.
Right.
But you're everywhere with the electric media. Now, you're saying in Supernature, he highlights his only notes are about ESP? That's what he's noting?
He's only got two notes. It's he notes the page where this ESP research happens and the page where they talk about the possum playing dead differently.
Right. And he doesn't make too much comment on the ESP because it's literate visual ESP. I think he's just noting it. So I want to ask Ion, do you have anything to say about ESP research in the 60s or now, Ion? Is that the world of effect versus affect?
Well, maybe potentially, but it's not even about that. It's about warming up to the whole position that you've got to get somewhere to get somewhere. If it's extra, you can't have sensory perception. Instead of ESP, why can't it just be SP?
Okay, so you've said that before. So you're saying let's not make it extra.
Well, it isn't extra because the bias that they achieved isn't even exemplary, let alone beyond it.
Okay, so literacy makes people feel more isolated and fragmented because it highlights the I and you read alone. So then they exaggerate reconnection because they feel it's been cut off by the book experience. So they overextend the desire for connecting, and they call that extrasensory perception. Whereas for pre-literate people,
well, they don't know it. They don't know it to start with, so everything to them is extra. They haven't had it the first time. If they can come into sensory perception, then they might note extra sensory perception. But they can't even acknowledge the first part.
Okay, let me just go back to Brian. Okay, Brian, next point, if you have one.
Sure. What I first said about the Baudelaire there was more just there weren't, McLuhan didn't have any notes about the hashish section. That was just part I read and was surprised by what a vertical biased guy Baudelaire seemed to be. But the very few notes on this book that McLuhan had made really put me in mind of the thing that you said once. I know you said it a few times, but the first time I heard it anyway, you were responding to Polar Bear on Alt.Flash.
Yeah.
He was trying to be kind of understanding and talking about Finnegan's Wake, at least, and McLuhan loving Joyce and all that. And you said McLuhan secretly hated Joyce.
Yeah.
And I found that pretty startling. But it does seem to his notes in the Baudelaire book seem to bear that out a bit, because, you know, it might seem like that's a strange thing to say. I mean, McLuhan, you know, they're saying that you can't. No more funny and joyous or something. No more funny book could be imagined. Seems to be praised, but in this Baudelaire book, it was The Essence of Laughter. again, you would kind of expect that Baudelaire, from his image, that he'd be all about laughter and
yeah.
the power of it, or the vitality of the madness of it or something. But what Baudelaire has to say about it, and what McLuhan underlines about it, is all about how these underlined phrases are, the comic is a damnable element. That's, McLuhan underlined that.
Yeah.
Baudelaire says that the comic is one of the more obvious marks of the satanic in man. McLuhan underlined marks of the satanic in man. And a few more underlines about that laughter is one of the most frequent symptoms of madness, and that and Baudelaire is particularly the thing that Baudelaire is his kind of point about why laughter and the comic is ultimately not a noble thing at all, is that it's about this idea of superiority, that it comes from
yeah.
a feeling of being superior to the thing you're laughing at.
Yeah.
And, you know, what could be more deplorable, he says, than weakness rejoicing in someone else's weakness. And so this idea...
Baudelaire says that? You're quoting Baudelaire?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that was Baudelaire.
Yeah.
And the one note that McLuhan made on the back page there... There are only a couple of notes, and some of them are just noting, like, okay, there he talks about ingress or modernity or something.
Yeah.
But the main note with all these underlines is page 115, madness, superiority, laughter. And Baudelaire is making this point that, laughter, physiologists say, comes of superiority, the idea of his own superiority. Dot, dot, dot. Okay, now it is a, this is Baudelaire, now it is a notorious fact that patients in a madhouse are all of them suffering from the idea in excess of their own superiority, like, or at least lunatics aren't known for their humility.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he says it should be noted that laughter is one of the most frequent symptoms of madness. And so McLuhan has underlined, comic is a damnable element, marks of the satanic in man, patient in a madhouse, he underlines. Laughter is one of the most frequent symptoms of madness, and then also underlines it on the next page that it's a another point about it being a symptom of weakness. He underlines that it's a nervous convulsion comparable to a sneeze. He underlines
yeah.
both of those phrases. That there will be found in the mental attitude of one who laughs and a certain unconscious sense of pride.
Yeah.
McLuhan underlines the unconscious sense of pride. And then Baudelaire says, the disciples of the romantic school, McLuhan underlines romantic school.
Yeah.
But goes on, or rather the subset of the romantic school that are the Satanists
yeah.
are well aware of this fundamental law of laughter. Dot, dot, dot.
That'd be the Crowley horizontal school.
Sure.
Crowley.
Yeah.
Crowley. That's
yeah.
awesome what you're saying. That is a very good thing, because that brings up a lot of echoes that I could replay. I mentioned a little while ago about music versus the eye. Baudelaire and Robert in Tottenham wants to know if we're talking about Baudrillard or Baudelaire. We're talking about the 1850 poet Baudelaire, not Baudrillard. Mm-hmm. So... he's heading towards the vertical theory, get serious side, which is not into the folky, musical, down at the tavern, pub, laughing and yucking it up, and life's a joke. Even Dylan, doesn't he say in John Wesley Harding, there are some of you that life's a joke, but we've been through that, and that's not our fate. You know, even Dylan gets that way after he can't handle the crowds. So
mm-hmm.
there's talking about a crowd dynamic. The literate man reacts to this. The other point was... McLuhan hates Joyce. Many people don't understand McLuhan enough to understand Don Thiel's book, The Medium is a Rearview Mirror. But if you go to the end pages of that amazing book, he points out and proves that McLuhan is a Lewisian in relation to Joyce and always mm-hmm. headed in for Joyce. And he talks a lot about Lewis... McLuhan does in the 50s, and says he's the key to the new media, but he has to switch to Joyce in the 60s because it's the psychedelic carnival of the global theater and the more monotone of Lewis is not going to communicate. You have to get their kids' attention by presenting a book that is psychedelic. You know, Phineas
Wake. world is too Joycean to ignore.
Yeah. Yes.
But then again, the world is, you know, it's the prince of this world is not the good one, right?
That's right. And it's not that McLuhan is, you know, Eric writes a very interesting foreword to The Medium in the Light, where he describes his father as not a tight-lipped conservative, not a nut radical liberal or something, something in between and neither, and just unique. And I think I understand that. He responds to the present depending on what he feels like and what his agenda in the moment is. And we have to look at Marshall is not categorizable the way Donfield does. But it's interesting to take that McLuhan was a Menippean rather than a Veronian satirist. Now, if O.J.'s listening, I just wrote to him about this 2 hours ago. Don makes the point that Joyce celebrated Eros and the carnivalesque more than Lewis. Lewis was a Menippean and cynical and maybe more on the I side, but the acoustic side, and Joyce is a singer, they love hanging out with the tribe. In the end, that's their most fun. And that's called the carnivalesque kind of satire. And it's called Veronian after Vero, V-A-R-R-O. So many people have heard about Menippean satire from me, but they didn't know about the Veronian twist on that Theo points out. So Lewis is a Menippean, cynical Menippean, favoring the eye detachment. McLuhan and Eric's side seem to go that side. This is the conventional McLuhan image, whereas Joyce is in the Dobbs-Thiel quadrant, raving nut, you know, evoking Ion to enhance the carnival.
Yeah.
So those are a couple thoughts that come up about these distinctions. So it's interesting that as a left hemisphere intellectual critical theorist, Baudelaire, they argue over these issues. Yeah, you're just hanging out, having fun with your friends and laughing, and the detached poets say, oh, rather satanic, this group here, right? It's funny where literacy takes you.
Yeah, yeah.
The extreme classification. I mean, they're arguing. And so then Lewis, he takes on Bergson. Bergson has a mechanical view of humor, where it's funny that man, what does he say? The man slips on the banana peel, and that's funny, so that's slapstick comedy, because you're seeing a human turn into a machine because he slipped on his ass. But Lewis says, no, humans are not human, they're machines. What's funny is the absurd attempt to be human. That's the root of humor.
Yeah, twisting it around there.
Yeah, and about I hear Carolyn giggling in the background, that reminds me. There's this incredible YouTube Roxy gave me in Mexico. I put it on my Facebook. She sent it to me personally, and I said, oh, man, I gotta help make this go viral. And it's probably the most terrible video you've ever seen where this this guy, I won't say anymore, this kid tries to protest. Well, I had seen it a few times, even to the point where Roxy and I are joking about it. And commenting, which familiarity breeds contempt, and then you start mocking something that shouldn't be mocked. Well, I showed it to Carolyn for the first time, and when she finished, she looked at me, and I was smiling about something, and she said, you find this funny? And she was outraged. I looked satanic in that moment that I was laughing at this shocking video, but I was 4 miles down the road. I had seen it many times and had switched into different responses. But there, Carolyn, you can say I look satanic there, right? Are you muted, Carolyn? Just don't nod. Yeah, I look satanic to you.
Yeah. It was,
you were shocked.
I was shocked and you were laughing.
Yes,
bizarre.
But I was laughing at other things.
Yeah.
I was several steps removed from the initial shocking experience. I'd been through it a few times. It is a shocking video. So without saying about it, I wanted to be a surprise. And
where can people see it?
At my Facebook page.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess you got to friend me, but most people here are my friend. I think they're hooked in. And let's just see who is here. Check the sound bites here. The template of we've got anybody who can talk about humor. Well, maybe let's hear what little Sarah says. Little Sarah, if that's your number, you want to speak about this laughing versus stiff upper lip? That might be Michael. Okay. Is that you, Sarah? Yeah, this is Sarah. You have anything to say, Sarah?
Do the Stoics come next was what I was wondering.
The Stoics are they tend toward the Menippean and cynical. They are not carnivalesque. They're not Veronian. They are the word Stoic.
Right, right.
As a matter of fact, when we watched Ion last week, when Ion separated from JW, we described JW as a jovial, bubbly face. But the serious face of Ion, later Ion said, he understood we were seeing a Stoic face. He called it Stoic. His own Ionic face was Stoic.
What about the meme, or the muse? The two.
The muse?
And then there's the pantomime. Yeah, and then the pantomime.
Well, the mime.
Right, and a pantomime is a mime that does five characters and their five emotions. That's similar to this, too, right?
Yes, that sounds like the eye. Though it's hard to figure out what... That's gesture, and gesture is not the eye. So I don't... Mime is, like, generally multisensory, but it's presented to the Westerner as a silent communication, like in the library. It would be, like, book-like, you know? There's no noise.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe literate people see mime as visual, and that would be detached. And, yes, the mime has the mask. Puts on the clown mask face, right? And that's,
it's black and white.
And it's hollow. There's nobody there.
But the two choices, that's what I'm wondering, like the Menippean satire, and you're telling, kind of going in an outline of it.
And the Baronian, yeah.
You're breaking it down to there's two, you're bringing in two subtypes of it? Is that what?
Yeah, there's two types of satire that satirizes and attacks the audience of the medium that's being entertained. And one is, in the end, that life is a comedy. And the other, not necessarily that it isn't a comedy, but they take the tragic, serious view and actually hate people. They hate humanity.
Is it kind of, you could say it's kind of analogous to Apollonian Dionysian?
Yeah.
Baronian is definitely Dionysian kind of a thing.
Yeah. And Thiel is...
Glass and one more round of all this madness kind of thing.
Yeah, and Thiel is definitely on the Dionysic side versus McLuhan's Apollonian because... Theo does make Dionysus a big factor in his concluding statements. I might read it many hours from now, his final short chapter. And he's all about Eros, and McLuhan's not including Eros. McLuhan's uptight. And so that is the Dionysiac, and Theo calls himself a Veronian satirist, not a Menippean. But Theo was a nudist, so maybe that's his bias. Now listen to this. He once was on a nude beach in the Bahamas or something. With his wife, and along comes Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, walk along nude, and I never got it straight whether his bodyguard was nude or not, but there are
Trudeau. That's a good question.
We actually got to see the Emperor with no clothes.
That's right. He did see it. And I don't think he told many people that. He told me in confidence, but I don't know if he ever would say it in public. It's probably not. It's probably respected the Prime Minister having privacy, you know, being taking a vacation. But he was known as a Randy Dude, right, Trudeau?
Randy Dude. He was well known to be Randy.
Yes.
That's funny.
Those French Canadians, they go right to heaven. They don't go to a seminar in heaven.
No, I was thinking that last week when that was presented. I knew it was a dialogue we were listening to that was a recording, but I honestly considered it. My first thought was, ooh, I'll go to the seminar.
Yes.
I'm being honest. When it was like, do you want to go to heaven or a seminar about heaven, I thought, ooh, I want to go to the seminar and be prepared.
That's right.
That's
you were beat up on all your life, so you're paranoid. You don't trust anybody. You tend to become Menippean, Sarah, in your natural background.
Right. Maybe.
Yeah, you're kind of Menippean. I mean, most of them consider you Menippean here. You attack everybody as a Menippean. They may miss your Veronian side. I witness your Veronian side, but in general, you may be quite bitter there. And
wow.
They have good reason for it. Yeah, so let's just see what Ion has to say about all this. You have anything about the Veronian versus Manippean satire, Ion? He's not even going to speak. I guess he...
More Machiavellian.
Oh, Machiavelli is interesting. That's right. You are Machiavellian in preference? Well, you don't have feelings.
She is.
me and Tupac.
Sarah is Machiavellian?
Hell yeah.
Well, that's true. I didn't want to say that. She's already...
Okay.
So that's to Ion to have no proper politesse and just blatantly nails it. Yes, Machiavellian. And Ion, okay, so what kind of humor do you prefer, Ion? Now, that's a stupid question. I know you don't have preference.
Not very funny.
Not very funny humor is the best.
Dude, that's subtle humor. That's awesome. Okay,
only like things that are barely funny.
Okay, Brian, maybe one more point, or you got something more than fun that you have to say?
Probably the best, let's see. I mean, that thing about the Baudelaire is just interesting. It would be interesting enough if McLuhan had just underlined those things, but that's pretty much all that he noted and underlined about that Baudelaire bug, that the comic is the satanic or whatever. But, okay, there's one more thing in...
You know, this is a good example, Brian, of the more you know, you realize the less you know. I mean, you're learning so much just by looking at these annotations.
For sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's really... This is definitely the best school of McLuhan we got at the library. Now that you're not around... on the radio or whatever every day.
Right.
The best substitute from the McLuhan school.
Yeah, but, someone was talking to someone in Toronto, and this young person says, you guys know Bob Dobbs? And the guy said, he's from Toronto. He says, that guy's a legend in Toronto. Now, there's something that I didn't know.
For people who know of you, you've definitely got that. Well, I mean, because you were genuinely baffling on the radio.
Yeah.
People are like, generally, if anyone's coming over any kind of major broadcast media or something, they're like, at best, they're funnier than you expect or something. But you were like really hard to figure out, and what the hell's up with this guy? And like,
why is he even on the radio? Why did he even let him on the radio?
Yeah, and like, what's weirder, if what he says about himself is true, or if it's not, and he's saying it anyway? Like, it's just not like, who knows which is even stranger? Like,
and maybe the younger generations are more used to the enigmatic because they live in an enigmatic, information overloaded environment. So it's actually appealing to be have a bit of charisma if you're a mystery person more than before.
Mm.
Or maybe it's the opposite. Yeah, I'm not sure with the Morpheus generation. They're quadriphenic, so they actually wouldn't have a side. But they would include what would not be acceptable for the baby boomers. They would include. Mm. You know, I had a point. You know about, what's his name? Sandy Perlman is complaining about the vinyl ruining the meaningful experience. No, digital ruining the meaningful experience that vinyl advocates. And he's the Abbie Hoffman of vinyl, trying to get people to go back and realize the incredible advantages of vinyl. And he was helping, he was celebrating these young kids, 40% of them in an audience were into vinyl. And he said it's they find it more meaningful. Well, you know what his mistake is? He doesn't know that pop music is not music. It's an environment. And it doesn't necessarily have to have semantic meaning. It's only the literate person looks for semantic meaning in the music world, and the looking for authenticity is going back to vinyl because you're trying to have a book experience with the music. Whereas the most people don't care about the music so much because it's more of the other environmental factors, the other senses including fashion, in music, in the music industry. Like, look at look at what's her name, Taylor Swift. He was shocked that she couldn't sing, and yet she is popular because she breaks up with guys, right, and tells a story. It's a totally different non-musical reason. So I just
it makes sense that it's more of the more pop music sphere, people whose experience of music is a much more kind of a social, corporate, fashion kind of thing, that, they're not really caring about vinyl. I mean, I remember myself and my friends, the point of being into vinyl was literally the richer texture of the sound that you could really notice. So it's more if you're trying to, I guess the vinyl is definitely more for people being into music as music and less as this very plugging into the...
Oh, you know what? McLuhan wrote that music was, in the late 60s, that music was, it was a corporate ritual for literate man to release his literate, like being in the crowd and have acoustic spaces assuage his visual bias. And then McLuhan's, but in the 60s, music was becoming a private concern. Now, that's a literate level, and that's what Dylan brought in, meaningful, weird, interesting lyrics. Whereas Pat Boone are more corporate guys, and even the black music is more corporate, and they actually, the blacks got a little screwed up trying to be meaningful in the late 60s, early 70s. Even Miles Davis didn't know what to do. So the corporate role of ritual was superseded by the white suburban consumer looking for a private meaning for music, and it actually became the musical wars. You know, which bands did you like? And it sounds like Sandy Pearlman is in that camp. He actually isn't aware of his own Western bias of critiquing the new phenomena for musical reasons. It's not a music, it's an environment. So it was a big idea I just wanted to say, since you're engaged with Pearlman this week. It just occurred to me yesterday, I came up with a McLuhan way of explaining his fetish about trying to get people back to vinyl. They're misinterpreting what the entertainment is. So then why do you perceive, I sort of noticed this over the past year, I don't watch the show, but I felt that Colbert and Stewart were going out of the fascination. What do you think that's, why is that?
You faded off. Yeah, I faded off, and it's interesting that even though Colbert is actually quitting the show, and he's done in at the end of this month.
Really?
Yeah, he's finishing the show. He's killing off his character. I mean, he's probably actually going to kill his character, because it's like a character.
Right.
Because he's taking over David Letterman's slot, but he's going to be taking it over as himself, Stephen
Colbert.
Well,
that means that you about a year ago when you started fading off, he noticed it. He knew that image was over.
Yeah, he'd had a certain real spark and a wad to blow with the Bush administration era.
Right.
And then when it was moving into the Obama geometry, that kind of threw his whole identity. And perhaps having something to do with me and the whole subgenius thing, he was able to blow another wad in the new geometry. But yeah, there's really, I mean, as much as I like that show and his, we could probably use his perspective continuing on, it's not really something that he needs to keep doing. But one thing I've noticed about those shows might have something to do with why it's fading off. I've noticed that Stewart, in particular, and actually another, not just Stewart and Colbert, but another couple hosts, the audience is starting to become more and more oppressive in their constant compulsion to applaud. They'll applaud anything. They'll interrupt, like any joke, they'll not just laugh, but start applauding and interrupt the thing. And I've started, over the last couple of years, I've started to really notice that you see some expressions of frustration on the host's faces where they're like, no, don't applaud that. Like, your applause is starting to become meaningless now. Like it's not like everything I say is such a fantastic slam that you need to applaud it.
Okay, let me ask Aya, what's going on there? Are the people demanding it?
It's a machine. The applause is a machine. It's not real.
Oh, you mean, well, why are they playing the machine more?
Trying to make it be valid. They're trying to validate validity.
It's the weakness of TV in general. It just can't get attention.
No, it's like your show, Bob. No one's listening.
Yes, I just said TV. No one's listening, and they're trying to have listenership. They're panic mode. It's panic. Panic engineer, Brian. Panic engineer.
Being marvelously orchestrated.
All right. Thank you very much, Ian. All right. Okay, Brian. So you faded out. It's faded out, and I didn't even know Colbert's already jumped ship. And what is Stewart?
You've got a couple of weeks left. I mean, I'm finding that even though my interest has been a bit more piqued to like, oh, well, now that he's only got a couple months left, if he's got anything else really interesting to say or an interesting idea for a little skit to do with his character, that he'll be pulling it out now and I should watch. But I'm having a hard time getting up the motivation to even make sure I go watch it. Because it's not, well, also I don't get the channel that it's on every night. I either have to stay up till 3 a.m. to watch it or go watch it on the internet.
Hey, email me when the last show is. I always often watch the last show, and it's the only show I see of any of these series. So I might watch his last show, see what it's like. But
yeah, I think it's December 18th, but I'll check that. And
I'm going to give you credit. You nailed Colbert about a year ago. You described the Dobbsian undertones of it and all that, and because you caught the ambiguity and with precision, it's like Rumpelstiltskin. You named him. That's his name.
Yeah.
He's gone.
He loses the momentum or something. It deflates the
right
point.
And the name in modern society, Quadrophenic society, is not a like Rumpelstiltskin. You had to guess his particular name, but the naming process, which is what Finney's Wake and McLuhan understood, is a multidimensional process of awareness. That's how you name Rumpelstiltskin today. He doesn't have a particular name. So the way you went on with a very complex description of the Colbert ridiculously bouncing off me and the subgenius thing took a long exegesis, took you an hour or two. But that is the naming process in a multi-bodied society. It's not nominalist anymore.
Yeah.
You could actually say you could have, and this might be a clue to how Thiel writes his book, you've got to bring in words, song, gesture, dance, a whole panoply of media and entertainment forms. You've got to do it all to express what you're up against, that you're trying to name.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes a lot these days. It's certainly not something you can fit in a couple of words.
Right. Okay, well, that was really good.